Integrating humanities and science is what our next guest on Current State seeks to accomplish with her research here at Michigan State University. Dr. Natalie Phillips is the co-director and lead faculty member for Literary Neuroscience and History of Mind at the Digital Humanities and Literary Cognition Lab. She studies what happens in the human brain when a person reads. Her work offers a fascinating look into the complex processes of the brain and suggests the developmental impact of literature can be profound, and she joins us on Current State to discuss her research and her findings. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Can you just tell us a little bit more about what you do here in the Digital Humanities and Literary Cognition Lab? This sounds fascinating. You process or analyze what happens in the human mind when a person is reading.
Yes, that's exactly what we're beginning to do. And so the lab itself is a much larger structure. So just sort of co-founded with my colleague Steve Rockman, sort of forwarding a whole series of interdisciplinary projects in things like literary neuroscience, but also the history of mind and digital humanities. Our particular study, today I'll be talking about the current centerpiece of the lab, which was an interdisciplinary experiment I've been working on first at Stanford and now at Michigan State that uses technologies from neuroscience, specifically fMRI, or functional magnetic resonance imaging, and fMRI-compatible eye tracking, to explore how our brain responds when we read a work of literature with different levels of attention. And here, it's actually when a group of PhDs in English read a novel by Jane Austen.
Fascinating. Why Jane Austen?
Jane Austen was an interesting choice. She is, one of the points of the study was to analyze the complexity of moving between two different levels of attention to reading. Close reading, which is a literary skill that's taught in the classroom that allows us to analyze or unpack the very structures that give a novel its richness and depth, and pleasure reading. And you can sort of imagine just sitting down and curling up with a good book. And Jane Austen, I happen to be an 18th centuryist, and Jane Austen is one of the few novels that still allows us to do both. You can imagine actually picking up a work by her off of the bookshelf and sitting down to read in an armchair for pleasure, but also studying in a literary classroom, assigning to a bunch of English majors or English PhDs to really unpack the richness of what she does.
How very interesting. Did you have a hypothesis? Do you have any kind of hypothesis going into this project?
I didn't in many ways. We expected to some degree to be seeing relatively, when I first began the study, actually, when I spoke with neuroscientists about it, we expected to see really minute and subtle changes in the brain in comparing these two forms of attention to reading Jane Austen. And their point was fairly straightforward. Everyone was going to be doing the same thing. They were all going to be reading this novel by Jane Austen, just in two different ways, reading for pleasure and then reading for literary analysis like you would in an English classroom. Because of this, we almost narrowed down to just focus on a very, very minute part of the brain just to see if we could see these incredibly subtle differences. Well, thank goodness we didn't. And because we acquired whole brain scans, what we've been seeing is, in fact, unbelievably diverse, almost global activations across the brain for most of our subjects, suggesting that literary analysis, and one of the core skills taught in humanities classrooms across the country, in fact, is engaging and orchestrating diverse cognitive regions of the brain.
So does that suggest that in developmental terms, that the richest kinds of reading to pursue would be something with a more complex framework, but that at the same time has this more pleasurable payoff? That seems to be where you're going with
yes.
this.
Yes. One of my jokes is that in the pilot study, we actually had to eliminate professors. PhD students were perfect, but professors had actually forgotten how to pleasure read. And one of the things that this had suggested was, but as we began to look at the results more closely, what we're seeing is not only these unbelievably broad and again, really global activations for literary analysis, for close reading that we never, far beyond what we would have expected, but also activations, an interestingly different set of neural signatures for pleasure reading, which really suggests the value of cognitive flexibility, of being able to sit down with a book and being able to modulate your attention, to be able to analyze a work of literature, but also still read it for pleasure, which suggests that professors probably have something to learn from being able to put the pencil down.
Who besides professors and PhD students would you like to study? I mean, are there more run-of-the-mill type non-academic people that you want to look at here?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. This, just to say openly, this is really just the very beginning of this type of work. This is one of the first studies of literary reading that's been done inside an MRI scanner. And so we're really just at the tip of the iceberg. There are all kinds. I would love to do studies of everyday students. I've had people from law approach me and talk about comparing this to legal reading, reading all sorts of different novels, not just Jane Austen, but perhaps, not just Pride and Prejudice, but Pride and Prejudice and Zombies.
Right. Well, it seems to me there are other genres, too, that work in this same way, that I think of crime titles mysteries as well that really require some degree of analysis, but at the same time is pure pleasure for some people.
And this is one of the next stages, I think, of this research. There was a really interesting study that just came out that suggested that award-winning literary fiction, popular fiction like Danielle Steele or John Grisham, and nonfiction all created different sorts of empathetic reactions in the reader, and in fact improved their responses to certain tests of empathy known as theory of mind. And one of the things that you can begin to start thinking about in terms of this is that to ask not just how to divide these into really tight groups and genres, separating out the John Grisham from the Jane Austen, but in fact to say, yes, some literary works, a number of works, are going to always be requiring us to modulate our attention in these ways, demanding richer analysis and allowing us sort of ebb and flow through these stages of sort of richer absorption in reading, getting really lost in a good book, and then pulling back and stopping to analyze and to reflect on what we're reading. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the larger goals of the study, is in fact, because we're using both fMRI and fMRI-compatible eye tracking, as well as having students at the end write literary essays where delightfully, to my surprise and delight, they ended up quoting from material from the text that they weren't even seeing, we can begin to put that together to start producing a sort of really complex real-time sense of how the brain is changing as we read, not just sort of a broad-scale comparison between these two types of attention that you can bring to fiction.
Where are these MRI units that you use for your research? Where does that actually take place?
So the work that I've been doing actually began at Stanford and then came with me when I moved here to Michigan State. So because we're using fMRI-compatible eye tracking, all of the research has been done so far there at Stanford. But one of the things I'm really excited about is beginning to do this research at MSU. And probably one of the most exciting aspects has been working with a really cross-college initiative group of interdisciplinary scholars who specialize in all kinds of approaches to brain research. And we're looking at, it's really early so far, but the creation of a interdisciplinary brain institute at MSU that will allow for these kinds of interdisciplinary experiments where you have a PI in English and a co-PI in neuroscience and collaborators from linguistics, radiology, et cetera, to emerge and flourish down the road.
Have you thought about people who take pleasure in the more analytical thing. What about situations where someone is pleased? In other words, what they find pleasure reading really involves this more complex analysis, this where there isn't necessarily a real clear split between the two.
Absolutely. I think, again, that this is part of the exciting thing that this research is showing. You know, though you might have expected to see just pleasure centers activating for the more relaxed style of reading, you know, being lost in a good book, and regions associated with work, attention, and cognitive load at work for literary analysis, what we're seeing, again, is these diverse and widespread cognitive activations, which suggests, at its simplest form, the way I like to boil it down is to say that pleasure reading has its own challenges, and close reading has its own pleasures, right? It really reveals to us this sophistication. Because we had students, our participants, write extended literary essays at the end as well, we can also begin to dig into something truly interesting, which is individual differences as well in people's responses to this literary work. And use that to begin to start mapping their attention as they move through the text.
Very interesting work being done here at Michigan State University. We thank our guest, Dr. Natalie Phillips, co-director and lead faculty for the Literary, Neuroscience, and History of Mind at the Digital Humanities and Literary Cognition Lab. Thanks for joining us, Natalie.
Thanks so much.
Good luck.